Blog Talk Radio.
L-I-V-A-E-N-G-S-T-O-E-N-E, Livingstone, C-O-L-L-E-G-E, who you with?
L-C.
Who you with?
L-C.
L-C, bring it.
Bring it.
Livingstone, 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 beneath our stone, the many seeds were sown. You set the right tone, you turn the light on as we move on. With our groove on, dignified, I feel bonafide, I feel good inside, even sanctified. God's on my side, it's the way we ride, my L-C pride is maximized.
My family.
Livingstone is homegrown in Salisbury, known for its legendary hood seminary, steady LC Carnegie Library. Livingstone does what is necessary to enhance its precious stones like a lapidary, with the care inexpressible beyond vocabulary, to create a sanctuary beyond the ordinary, school of hospitality, arts and culinary, holistic instruction that's visionary, student health center and its apothecary, barrack auditorium where it seems like a canary, learning methods may vary but the efforts never tarry, sweet knowledge from a college like a sweet black cherry, athletes ready to defeat the adversary, Tubman building where the author literary, black history readily beyond February. Now the blueberry is a rare species. The blueberry has no fear of enemies. His intellect is what they respect. For intellect is in effect, we put opponents in check. Since 1879, L.C. stood the test of father time. Dr. Joseph Price, Bishop J.W. Hood paid the price of sacrifice so we could break the chain from the mental plantation, fill our brains with the best education, heal the pain of insane degradation. When we claim education, we can gain liberation. We're not kegging like HBCU. Historical black with a knack to rise anew. Nothing can hold back the black and blue.
Come on,
Livingstone, this track is for you.
You have
me. Ow, I want to know. L-O-V-I-N-G-S-T-O-N-D, Livingstone, C-O-L-L-E-G-E. Who you with?
L-C.
Who you with?
L-C.
Let's bring it.
Bring it.
Like a garment that's fitted. The L-C district is closely knitted. So let me be explicit. We are family and I'm happily knitted with it. Instructions are holistic, committed. Our spirit is befitted, and we know God did it. Victory in the face of adversity, fervently using faith as necessity. Universally with diversity, a Christian university. God have mercy. New trend, old trend, anywhere we represent. The blueberry is there and his pride is evident. We're not blinking, faith not shrinking. We're rising above tides and we're not sinking. From the top to the bottom, our arms are linking. Like a chain of brains to LC, we're clinging. Our presidents represent phenomenal thinking. From Dr. J. Price to Dr. J. Jenkins. L-I-V-E-N-G-S-T-O-N-E, Livingstone, C-O-L-L-E-G-E. Who you with?
LC.
Who you with?
LC.
Well, let's bring it. From LC to the mystery of hereafter, America's the HBCUs of Africa. We're all better when we're all together, even when the darkest of nights may fester. How dark the night, it does not matter. No weapon against us in the blue bear battle. The blue bear is tougher than the thickest leather. We're sticking together, come whatever. Out here the level, we stomp the devil. And yes,
I'm a radical blue bear rebel. Now, I want to know.
We are the mighty LC. The blue bear spirit is all over me. We bring it as a fan. We bring it, yes, we can. We will bring it as the LC campus expand. We will bring it like a team. We bring it with the fan. We bring it like dreams from kings who took a stand. But bring it humbly, yes, so grand. We will bring it like the Blue Thunder Marching Band.
Bang.
And when we glow on Monroe Street, we put pep in our steps like step shows from Greeks like K8 Psi, 858, Omega Psi Phi, AKA DST, B5B.
It's a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful thing. The HBCU is a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful thing. I'd like to welcome everybody to the Brothers for Real radio show tonight. I'm Leon, and I think I have another brother on the line with me, Joseph. We'll talk to him in a minute. I need you guys to call in and talk to me every now and then. Like I say, the brothers enjoy talking to ourselves, but every now and then we like for you to come in and call in and holler at us. Our feelings aren't hurt that you don't. We just like for you to do that every now and then.
Anyway, like I said, I'm Leon, and I got Joseph on the line. I'm gonna give you a number to call in in case you do want to call in. Give your HBCU a shout out tonight. The number to call in is 215-383-3872. Joseph, welcome to the show tonight, brother. How you doing, man?
I'm doing great, Leon. I appreciate you, your diligent and committed service to the Brother For Real radio show and all the other things that you do to uplift our people and to give us the information that we need. Thank you for all that you do, and I'm doing great here in Charlotte, North Carolina.
All right, brother. Same to you, brother. Appreciate what you're doing, man. Service to the people. Sure. That's what it's all about. Service to the people. Need to make sure we stay the course of servicing the people. Service to the people, guys. Service to the people.
Right.
We wanted to talk about HBCUs mostly tonight, but we would like to give a shout out to some of the sorriest people we know, the Republicans. We just can't believe people can be that sorry. I did not realize it until now that people could be that bad. I've been enlightened as to why our country doesn't. How can I say this? Anyway, I've been enlightened. I'm very disappointed to see so many mean people in power. It gives me motivation to make sure that I encourage as many people as I can to use that power to vote, because we've been bamboozled and hoodwinked so long that a lot of us don't think our vote matters, and they do. Our votes do matter, and if you don't believe something matters, if it takes somebody trying to take something from you to believe it matters, you're experiencing that every day, each and every day. So we want to give those guys a shout out. We like for them to know that we know that they're pretty disgusting. It's pretty disgusting to see people lie in your face over and over again. Take one position today, take another position tomorrow, take one position on the one president, take another position on another president. I'm just disgusted. I am totally disgusted. Totally. I cannot imagine being any more disgusted than I am right now.
Yep.
And they just keep coming. They don't stop. There's no shame to the game.
Mm-hmm.
I'm totally disgusted.
Yep.
Yes, sir.
You go ahead.
No. Go ahead.
Like you were saying today, it's just embarrassing. It's embarrassing. It's embarrassing to know that these people are the people that actually running the government and making the laws that we have to live by. It's just embarrassing that they don't have any integrity, no morals, no convictions. They just go with whatever it is that benefits them and the little political niche that they've carved for themselves. And whichever way that niche goes, it doesn't matter whether they're right, whether they're wrong, somewhere in the middle, that's where they go. They just don't have any morals. Just like people like old Howley and Ted Cruz and Rubio and Lindsey Graham, Mitch McConnell. I mean, them jokers. You know, and when you see how these jokers are, you know, how spineless and no conviction at all, you understand how Trump was able to emerge as the leader of the party.
Right.
Because Trump just comes out, well, in other words, like one man said, Trump did not make them who they are. He just revealed who they are.
Right.
Because Trump is not a politician, so whatever's on his mind, he just comes out and say it. And then, of course, there were a lot of people that believed what he was saying, and that's how they—that's why they were in, you know, stepped right in line behind him. But I'm just embarrassed by people like Lindsey Graham and Mitch McConnell. And, you know, it's like I was saying, I wish the people on Saturday Night Live would do a skit, you know, where they would show Lindsey Graham debating himself.
Well, they basically do that already, Joe. Some of the news outlets. They just show him
right.
talking one. They split screen on Lindsey Graham talking. It's like two totally different people. But here's what I want to ask Joe. Joe, answer this for me. You're a historian. What did they were clearly trying to disenfranchise all of these 80 million other people who voted for Mr. Biden and Ms. Harris. What did they expect us to do if they overturned it?
Well, what they expected to do was for us to, you know, sit back and do nothing and accept it, because what Trump was dependent on, and what he was actually dependent on the day of the insurrection, was the military to support him in his nefarious scheme and his behavior. But thankfully, the military people, which of course a lot of people don't think was a good idea, but they just didn't go along with it. But they, if Trump would have been able to overturn this election, basically overthrow the government with what he'd have been doing, and then have the most powerful military in the world backing him up, that would have been a pretty dangerous situation for the 81 million people that voted for the Democrat, voted for President Joseph Biden. And of course, and that's what he was counting on. And see, authoritarian rule, that's how they rule, that they rule by force. And seeing if he could have gotten that force behind, solidly behind him, that's what he was counting on. You know, it's like, say, for example, in South Africa, for example, you know, during, you know, apartheid, you know, it was a very small group of people that was running that country. But how they were running that country, they had the military might behind them. And basically, that's how Anglo-Saxons, Caucasians, Europeans, or whatever you want to call them, that's how they've maintained power throughout history, by having military might backing them up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what Trump was counting on.
Wow. Well, God does not sleep.
Oh, no.
That's what people have to remember. God does not sleep.
What people have to remember also is, like I've been saying, ever since I was able to talk, that only power we have is unity.
That's
and
right.
We have to be more vigilant about unifying ourselves, unifying our communities, unifying our families, and keep us pretty much focused on uplifting and caring and taking care of ourselves and taking care of our children. Because, and I've repeated this quote hundreds of times, that oppressors never change.
That's right.
Oppressors never change. I mean, these people, they've been doing what they're doing for thousands of years, and they're going to keep doing it as long as it continues to work for them.
That's right.
And the only time they're going to change is when the oppressed people change. And that's what we have to. And when I say about change, the biggest thing change you got to do is start caring about each other, start looking after our own families, looking after our own communities, because we don't want to be seduced and believing that the government is going to be the answer to all of our problems.
Now, amen.
Of course, I'm excited about having a new administration up there, but we can't think that if now we can, you know, let our guards down. We can't let our guards down or our guards down.
Time to go to work, buddy. When you are.
It's time to go to work.
We got to help them. We got to help them do what they need to do, bro.
That's right. We got to help them do what we need to do. And the only reason that anybody right now is talking about, you know, the issues affecting black people, because black people came out and voted, and they came out in large numbers.
That's right. Very large numbers. So we're going to get these, we're giving these guys enough time. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about North Carolina Central University and their impact on the Super Bowl. I mean, Super Bowl. Is that good?
And it's four colors. Okay.
Weren't you at the weren't you in the band? Were you in the band at Central?
Yeah.
You were in the band at North Carolina Central. Wow.
Yes, sir.
What'd you play? What was your instrument?
Played a tenor saxophone.
Tenor sax.
Yes,
you were in the
sir.
Band in high school too, right?
Yes, sir.
I don't know how I missed it. I think I'm gonna give people a little bit of history. Here's what happened. I wanted to be in the band just like my big brothers. But what happened was Integration came along. Got a little background on all that, Joe.
Okay, I'm away from it.
All right. Yeah, what happened, Integration came along, and so you guys, well, you started out in the band at Faison, is that correct? During
that is correct.
That's correct.
That is correct.
See, by the time I came along and wanted to be in the band, Integration had started. So at Faison, you didn't have to pay anything to play in the band. You borrowed a school instrument. Is that correct?
That's exactly right.
That's exactly right. So when I got to Waysbury Elementary School, they announced if everybody wanted to be in the band, come to the auditorium or to the band room. I jumped my little happy behind up and went in there. And I got in there, and Wayne Davis, I think, was the band director. What was that?
Huh?
What in the world was that? But anyway, so Wayne Davis said, well, you have to have your own instrument to play in the band. I said, what? the one you didn't have to have an instrument when he played in the band. And neither did Aaron, neither did Robert. So then he said, I said, well, so I got smart. I said, okay, well, I want to play. I know they weren't going to make it by a tuba or sousaphone. I said, well, I want to play the sousaphone. Anyway, you got to start out on the cornet or the trumpet. I got up and walked out, bro, because I knew I couldn't afford on an instrument. I got my little happy tail up and walked out. That was the end of that story, bro. I didn't even bother to come home and say, Dad, I need an instrument. Maybe I should have.
Yeah.
But I really wanted to be in the band.
Yeah.
I wanted to be in the band.
Yeah, being in the band was a good experience, especially when I got to North Carolina Central University. You know, being in the band at that moment was, you know, it was fun. But when I got to North Carolina Central University, I mean, it went to a whole new level.
Oh, yeah.
Because when I was at Bowman, you know, basically we always had the little, I don't even know what to call the things anymore, but the little thing that you put on your horn so you can read your music while you're playing and marching.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, you didn't memorize any music.
Right.
And, so when I got to North Carolina Central, of course, whatever, I can't even think of the name of the little thing you put on your horn so you had your music.
They didn't have any of those things.
All your music, you had to play it by, you know, I mean, of course, we practiced with the sheet music. But we learned it, and then when we got on the field, we played without that, sheet music in front of us. Because at North Carolina Central, what we were doing, we were playing and dancing at the same time. Just like
you can't read music and do the funky chicken at the same time and blow the
horn. No, you can't do all that. so you had to memorize that music, and I had two exciting experiences at North Carolina Central, you know, with the band. We went to Atlanta, Georgia, and we did the Battle of the Bands. And I'm sure you all have seen that movie, Drumline.
Yes, sir.
And but that movie was pretty accurate as to how it was to be in an HBCU band. I mean, because, you know, as a matter of fact, one of the characters that Anthony Brown, he was playing the band director for Morris Brown University.
Yeah.
And of course, Morris Brown was one of the bands that was in the Battle of Bands when I went to the Battle of Bands in Atlanta. It was North Carolina Central, Morris Brown, Florida A&M. And back then, Florida A&M had about 400 pieces. We had about 150. You know, back then, those black bands were really, really, really big.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, Florida A&M band, they covered the whole field from goalpost to goalpost.
I remember we used to take Scent and Lillian back to college. Once you ride with Dad to take Lillian and my sister Ellen back to college. I said Scent and Lillian because we know brothers are talking. But I know that band had at least 150 back then.
Yeah, yeah.
And they played beautiful music, man. It was just beautiful.
Yeah, and then we did, and back then, of course, you see all this halftime stuff that goes on, you know, at these football games, professional football games.
Mm-hmm.
See, back then, they were bringing a college band to do the halftime.
Right.
And of course, and they would televise the whole thing, you know.
I remember when y'all went to play for the Philadelphia Eagles.
Yep, we did a halftime show for the Philadelphia Eagles and the Washington Redskins.
I remember that.
Our intro was Jesus Christ Superstar. And then we broke out in Backstabbers, came up the field doing our routine. Dun, 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 dun. Boy, and everybody. And back then, you know, a lot of black people didn't go to a professional football game.
Right.
And there were probably about 60,000 people in that stadium. And they were quiet as mouse. And then all of a sudden, I heard they had a little cone up there. They had about about 25 or 30 black people up there. And that's why we look, they were just a shock.
Felt good, didn't it, bro?
It felt good. I was saying, because some other people, like I said, they really wasn't feeling us. They really wasn't feeling backstabbers and play fence walk and Freddy's dead. They really weren't feeling that. But it was a great experience. It was a great experience. There's nothing like the HBCU experience. And I think we're getting ready to see a resurgence in black HBCUs. You know, because, of course, like you want to talk about Leon Knight, there's a lot of great athletes come out of HBCU. And, of course, scholars. You're like, well, the first two black quarterbacks to play on Super Bowl, they both came from HBCU. Of course, right. Everyone knows about Doug Williams, how he came in as a backup for Trader. That was his name, Trader. He was the backup quarterback for Trader, and Trader got hurt, of course. And then Doug Williams had to come in and fill in, you know, because at the time, because when Joe Gill got Doug Williams to come to play for the Washington Redskins, Doug Williams wasn't even working. He didn't even have a job.
All right.
And he came in as a backup and went to the Super Bowl and set all kind of records. Then, of course, you know, Steve McNair, he was a Southern black quarterback. Now, of course, he didn't win, but he did play in the Super Bowl. And, of course, he was out of Alcorn University.
Okay.
And, of course, you know, Walter Payton, Sweetness, Rice. All these guys. What was his first name? What was Rice's first name? Set the all-time receiving record. Sweetness out of Jackson State, all-time rushing record. And then, of course, in this Super Bowl coming up, a lot of folks don't know it, but the Tampa Bay Buccaneers got five players from HBCUs on that team.
Wow.
And two of them from North Carolina Central University.
What's your mouth, man?
Huh?
You serious?
You say, am I serious?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm serious. You know that. You sent me an email.
Hey, man, that was radio talk.
So
I got you, man. Okay.
I know that was radio tech, but I was just being brother for real.
I know, right? You're keeping it real, brother. I hear you.
You're keeping it real. Yeah, so you know, I don't know about Mahomes. I like Mahomes. I like Mahomes, but I got some real homes on the other team.
You know, where did Mahomes come from?
I don't know what home. I don't know where he came from. I don't know what. I ain't punching. I like Mahomes, but we got some homies on there. We got some homies on the other team.
Real homies.
We got some real homies. So I may have to, you know. But you know, either way it turns out, I'm gonna be pretty happy. You know, so. I'm not gonna cry either way. But while we're on the subject of HBCUs, I like to talk about them HBCUs that were represented at the inauguration.
Wow, what about that? That's deep too,
well,
right?
Of course that's deep. Of course, Kamala Harris, of course, the first female vice president in the history of this 244-year-old nation, the first female vice president, first of all, is a woman of African descent, and secondly, she is from a graduate of an HBCU, Howard University. And of course, you know, Howard has a history of putting out good scholars. You know, Thurgood Marshall, the first black Supreme Court justice, came out of Howard. And of course, James Clyburn, he was at this inauguration, of course. And of course, Thurgood Marshall wasn't here, because you know, everybody knows he's dead. But anyway, I just threw him in there because he was the first black Supreme Court justice. But, of course, James Clyburn, he's a graduate of South Carolina State. He was there, you know, South Carolina State Bulldogs. And he and Kamala had a little HBCU chat during the inauguration because I saw Kamala come over there and whisper something in his ear, and he started smiling, and he pointed at that South Carolina State cap he was wearing. And of course, and I told Patricia, I said, "Them Negroes over there talking HBCU at the inauguration." And of course, you know these news people,
Go ahead.
I said, "You know these news people, they don't miss anything, so they picked up on it too. So they asked James Clyburn about it later on that in an interview. And of course, James Clyburn, he pretty much gave a history of HBCUs right there on MSNBC. Television talking about the history that not North Carolina Central, but HBCUs had of producing great leaders in the world, just like McNair, you know, the astronaut, the first black astronaut. Of course, you know, he came out of North Carolina A&T, and of course we had Warner, the first senator out of Georgia, graduate of Morehouse University. And, of course, you know, Stacey Abrams, she's out of Spelman University. And Bottoms, the mayor of Atlanta, she's a Florida A&M. So the HBCU, they have been on the national scene in large numbers recently, they are representing well. And one of our chancellors said one year at a meeting, he told us, he said, y'all need to stop letting people talk down HBCUs. Y'all need to be the one at the forefront to stop them from doing it.
That's right.
Because there's a concerted effort to turn our young scholars away from HBCU, even with the great history that they have in scholarship, leadership, politics, sports. You just go down the line. All of your leaders, for the most part, have come out of HBCUs. But still, people want to talk down about HBCUs. It seems like people are just programmed. At the shopping center this weekend, had on a North Carolina Central gear. The first thing woman said, African American woman, first thing she said, that's where he got all that crime at. What was it? In North Carolina Central? I said, you didn't just see these people go in and invade the Capitol and threaten to hang the vice president, but you talking about crime at North Carolina Central? You hadn't read about the big international drug ring that was going on at Duke University and University of North Carolina. Has been all over the news. And you're going to talk to me about crime at North Carolina Central University? And I'm thinking, I'm sure there's some crime there. Got to be crime there because there's crime everywhere.
Yeah.
Because when I was up there, I know I committed some crime. But it wasn't nothing that was going to make make the national news. But it seemed like people have just been programmed. Unfortunately, black people have just been programmed to talk against, talk down HBCUs. And folks need to cut that out. You know, we can't take the ways of our oppressors. We can't envy their ways and take any of their ways. You know, we need to be talking up whatever it is that we have. We need to be talking up for it, speaking up for it. If it's our churches, our communities, our children, our colleges, we need to be talking up, speaking up for these, speaking up for it. I'm sorry, Leon, I took us all this time.
No, that's okay, because I was thinking about the irony of what happened to me at a shopping center in Salisbury, because, you know, I'm a Livingstone College alumnus. And the lady was saying, she was up there, take my son home. And I said, well, what's up? She said, well, much crime up here. I looked at her, I said, well, I said, ma'am, crime's everywhere. I said, excuse me for saying that. I said, but crime's everywhere. So I just asked her, Joel, out of just wanting to know. I said, where are you taking it? She said, I'm taking him to North Carolina Central, way back where we were from. North Carolina Central.
Well, then what I'm saying, see, that's how views our people are. Man, like Linda Graham.
do that too. Well, yeah. They earned that one. You're right. They earned that criticism you just gave them.
Yeah, but it's just you know, this black historian was on MSNBC. I think it was last night, and he was talking about what it would have been like. He was talking about what it would have been like in the United States, how the political map would have changed, and of course it would have changed for our good. He said if all had never been a migration to the North, in other words, if black people just would have stayed in the South, that for the most part we would have controlled the political arena in the South. He said he predicted probably he said there would probably be about 17 black senators in the United States Senate and probably 100 in the House of Representatives if we had just stayed in the South. And then and the reason I bring that up is because I've often thought about what it would have been like if some of our brightest minds and our best athletes hadn't abandoned the HBCUs.
Right.
Abandoned the HBCUs. Now, you know, I understand everybody can't go to an HBCU. It's like, you know, it's like really because most of the HBCUs are in the South. And the reason they are in the South because, well, white folk wouldn't let black folk go to college with them in the South. And that's why,
I was just going to say a lot of it has to do, of course, with, you know, whitewashing and whitewashing and how organizations, those schools have what they call prestigious Ivy League and all that stuff, those kind of reputations. But what we as African-Americans have to realize is it's not the school you go to, but what you get from that school.
That's right.
You know, a lot of African-Americans don't realize the kind of impact. See, what they don't get. Excuse me for saying this, people that are going to those Ivy League schools and stuff and those other schools. But what they don't get is, you see, they're white racists everywhere. And I'm not white racists. They're everywhere.
Oh yeah,
and white supremacists, and sometimes you get caught in those situations where people just don't have your best interests at heart.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not talking about any specific schools. I'm just talking about in general.
That's right.
Realize that happens, but why would you put yourself in that situation? That's to say, to a prestigious school. You may get lucky and not run across a white racist or a white supremacist while you're in those schools, but I've heard some real horror stories of people getting caught up in those situations in college. But nevertheless, I guess we'll move on, man. So you guys are looking forward to a big Super Bowl, and I'm really excited myself, man. I mean, I will be honest with you. I was Tom Brady hating. And you kind of have to look over Tom Brady.
That's right.
You know?
Yeah. from you. And while we're on the subject of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, when Doug Williams graduated from college in 1974. That's when graduated from high school. He graduated from high school in 1974. Then he graduated from college. He graduated from college in 1974. So when Doug Williams graduated from college in 1974, he was a fourth runner up. We're talking about Doug Williams, the first black quarterback to play the Super Bowl, the Washington Redskins. He was the number four runner up for the Heisman Trophy that year.
Okay.
I think he was the number four runner up for the Heisman Trophy. And then not one NFL school, not one NFL school. Mm-hmm. But Joe Gibbs at the time, he was the offensive coordinator for the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. He was offensive coordinator for the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, and he came down and talked to Doug Williams and gave Doug Williams an opportunity to play starting quarterback. Paid Doug Williams $120,000 a year, which made him the lowest paid quarterback in the NFL. And actually, I think they said about 12 backup quarterbacks were making more money than he was making. But anyway. But Doug Williams did get an opportunity. Now, before Doug Williams came to the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, of course, was a new franchise, and they had won two games in 2 years.
Hmm.
And after Doug Williams came to the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, Tampa Bay Buccaneers went to the playoff 3 years in a row. And in the final year that Doug Williams was at Tampa Bay in 1979, they went to the NFL championship game. They didn't win, but they were there. That's how competitive they were. Now keep in mind, Doug Williams wasn't making but $120,000 a year.
Mm.
So Doug Williams went to the owner and asked the owner for $600,000 a year. And the owner said no. And he offered him $400,000, and he wasn't going to budge on that. He wasn't going to budge on that. And so even the coach was upset that they wouldn't pay Doug Williams that $600,000. So Doug Williams quit, and went and joined this startup franchise. It was something like the Oklahoma Outlaws or something like that. But anyway, that league that he was in folded, and Doug Williams was sitting home doing nothing. Now, keep in mind, now the first time Doug Williams got an opportunity to play in the NFL, it was Joe Gibbs, who was the offensive coordinator at the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. Now this same Joe Gibbs is the coach at the Washington Redskins now. And so he's the one called Doug Williams up and asked him to play backup quarterback for the Washington Redskins. So somebody with that much talent like Doug Williams had, there was just one white man that really got him in the NFL two times. I mean, and Doug Williams, and by the time he got to play for the playing that Super Bowl, Doug Williams had gotten pretty old. You know, Doug Williams, you know, old as I am, born in 1955. So he ain't no spring chicken by no stretch of the imagination. He wasn't an old man, but he was old, you know, for football. You know what I'm saying? His best years were behind him. And of course, and it was in the main reason he didn't Doug Williams probably could have been the best quarterback in the history of the NFL, but he just didn't get a chance because of racism. But I think it's somewhat ironic. Well, maybe not ironic, or maybe that's just what the Tampa Buccaneers Tampa Bay Buccaneers do. They gave Doug Williams an opportunity, and that's probably why they got these five players from HBCUs on the team now.
It's amazing, man, what's going on out there now. Though we're going to take another little break, man, for a minute, then we'll be back. We're going to close this thing out, man. But I wanted to play this song right here. You asked for about five, six shows. So.
All right, man.
Check this out, man. It was 14 of us. You were number what?
Number eight gate.
Number eight gate. I'm number 11 gate. Think about mom and dad often, man. See, now, they were growing up back there in the, I mean, you know, 60s.
Yeah.
Very seldom heard them mention anything about racism. I thought that was pretty interesting.
You know why, Leon?
Please tell me.
It was just a way of life. Keep in mind when the Civil War started in 1861, Daddy was born just 56 years later.
Daddy.
You feel what I'm saying?
I'm getting it. Yeah, I'm getting there. I'm listening.
So what I'm saying is, when Daddy was a teenager, he knew a whole lot of black folks that had been slaves.
Hmm.
As a matter of fact, Daddy knew his granddaddy, Henderson Gatewood. Because, you know, Henderson Gatewood, our great-granddaddy, born in 1845, of course, he was born a slave. And, of course, Daddy knew him. So I'm saying that to say this, you know, When Daddy and those grew up, they probably didn't talk about racism because that just the way things were. You follow me?
Yes, sir.
They see a sign that says white only. Well, that didn't bother them because that's the way things were.
That was the law.
Mm-hmm. Even though we had laws passed to say that it was illegal, of course, it was like you said, the 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment, 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment that was passed after the Civil War. All of that should have taken care of all the problems that black people were having in America. But white people just did not have the proclivity to adhere to the laws that had been passed by the government, passed by the courts, and most of the executive branches, the president, proclivity to execute the laws that were on the books as it applied to equal rights and justice for black people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just like, of course, you know, 1896, we had Plessy versus Ferguson, which said segregation was okay, but it had to be equal. But we know that never happened. We know that black people have the 14th Amendment gives us equal protection of the law. We know that never happened. 15th Amendment gave black men the right to vote. We know that there's always been voter suppression in the South against black people. And of course, and like I said, those laws have always been on the book, but they have just never been implemented or never been enforced. So the reason that them grumpy aunts didn't talk about race, that was just a way of life for them. That was a way of life. Discrimination was okay. Discrimination was pretty much accepted.
Right.
That was just a way of life. That wasn't nothing to talk about. That would have been the same way, you know, us talking about, you know, some of the things that's, you know, natural to us these days, you know.
Right. Well, I didn't, you know, of course, didn't notice it until I grew out of it. You know, once we started reading about racism and stuff like that, I mean, we knew it was going on around us, but it just seemed like we were sheltered from it. It kept us sheltered.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think Daddy made an effort to keep us sheltered from it. Dad, you know, they kept us, you know, just like, for example, you know, I always wanted to go to movies when I was down in Anson County.
Yeah.
You know. But, you know, but for the most of the years in Anson County, the movie was segregated.
The black folk had to sit in the balcony.
Yeah, black people had to sit in the balcony.
Way back then.
The first time I went to the movie, I might have been a senior in high school. The first time I went to the movie, I went and sat down on the lower level. You know, because you could do it then. But that was the first time I went to the movie. I didn't ever go to the movie until I could go. And it wasn't segregated.
Was that intentional, yeah, or you just didn't? It didn't happen.
Well, you know, when I went that time, there was a lot of black folks up in the balcony. I didn't know why they was up there. I noticed I saw a Negro sitting down there, but, you know. But I didn't know why they were up there until later on. But, you know, because, you know, they had been going to the movie all along, you know, because, you know, they lived uptown.
Right.
We live down on 52, so we didn't know about what was going on uptown. I didn't know. I might have been having a sit-in and didn't even know it. I knew it then. because we went to segregated school. What year did you start the school, Quincy?
What year?
What year did you start school? First grade.
1964.
You go to integrated school or segregated school?
I started out at Faison. It was segregated. So when I left there, I went to Waysboro Elementary in the sixth grade year. So I stayed at Faison for 5 years. My first integrated year was the sixth grade.
And see, the point I'm making is, see, the Supreme Court had ruled that segregation was illegal in 1954.
Okay.
You feel what I'm saying?
Yeah. 10 years.
You know what I'm saying? You know, 10 years before, and you were still going to segregated school. So, in other words, all these people talk about law and all, these people ain't never cared nothing about no laws when it came to black people.
Right.
I mean, just like I started school in 1960. Segregation had been ruled illegal by the Supreme Court when I was 1 year old.
Hmm.
But I went to segregated school all the way till I got to the ninth grade. That shows you right there, these people never cared anything about any laws. Them people don't care about no laws. And just right now, that's the main reason right now why they're trying to get away from democracy. They pretend like they want democracy, but right now they're becoming fatigued by democracy, because the white power structure, they're beginning to see their power eroded by, of course, you know, the enfranchisement of, you know, black American, a lot of them have finally figured out that they can vote and will go vote. Then, of course, you got the Hispanics and you got the Asians and, you know, a lot of these other folks come to the United States, and a lot of these folks, they just gonna vote their interest, and they're not gonna be voting according to your beliefs about white supremacy, about white folk being in power.
That's right.
And because the Republican Party makes only 25% of the electorate in the United States, and that's something. They make up only 25% of the electorate. And the reason that they are holding on to power, they can't hold on to power because they're doing a lot of gerrymandering, doing a lot of voter suppression, and that's why they think that this election was rigged, because they've been rigging so many elections to get elected. The way they don't think it's rigged, but this time what happened is the rigging didn't work, and so that matters why they're saying this was rigged.
They can't figure out why the rigging didn't work. So they think it got rigged over their rigging.
Yeah, because I don't know whether you read today, one of Trump supporters got arrested today for voter suppression.
Really?
One of his supporters got arrested today for voter suppression, and little white boy, woman, 31 years old, but say he had a misinformation campaign going on social media. And of course, because of his little social media campaign, you know, they felt like he was creating an atmosphere of voter suppression. And they came and locked him up.
Locked him up.
He'd probably get out, go to court and all that. And of course, he'll get a lot of these rich folk behind him to support him. But as of right now, he had been under arrest, and he was a number one Trump supporter. And right now, he's been arrested for voter suppression. You'll read more about it. I can't think of the boy's name. I just saw the news flash right before the show started.
Yeah, I was reading earlier today that also they charged out about 400 of that, however many thousand out there. Well, that's about 1% of that 40,000 that were out there. The guy,
right.
Huh?
Go ahead, I'm listening.
Yeah, I'm just saying they've charged about 400 of them with crimes and misdemeanors and felonies and all that kind of foolishness. But my sad part is, my thing is, man, a lot of these guys, the sad part about America is they're using these poor whites. Now, a lot of these guys up there, they went up there, were not poor whites, but the majority of them clearly were. Because you had people up there spending their life savings on you're driving private jets up there and all kind of foolishness to get up there to show off. And now they locked up a lot of them. But, you know, like I know, a lot of these guys are being played the fool. They're playing the fool with them, you know, just to get their agendas across. Got them out there fighting on all them meth heads and crack heads up there. Carrying on the way they're carrying on, because you had to be on meth or something to be busting into that building like they were doing.
Yeah.
It's crazy, man.
But, you know, the unfortunate thing, it's so unfortunate, and I've said this as sincere as I can be. It's unfortunate how the establishment has used the working class white people for years to get their agendas across. And of course, and like Dr. Martin Luther King said in one of his books, he said, anytime a working class white man would come and complain about his living conditions or the fact that he didn't have adequate housing, he wasn't making enough money, or his kids wasn't able to go to the best schools, or he wasn't able to get adequate health care. The because he was not black.
Hmm.
If he couldn't feed his children, that's okay because you're not black.
Mm-hmm.
If he come in and ask for a raise, you know, because he wasn't making enough money, they would tell him, well, if you won't work for this amount of money, I hire a black man. And
mm-hmm.
after you tell him that, you'll go back to working for that, you know, for those low wages that he was being paid.
And that's a shame.
It's a shame. And see what working class white people have to one of these days come to realize that they have more in common with us than they have with the Mitch McConnells and the Ted Cruzes and the Rubios of the world. Because see, these people like Ted Cruz and Rubio and Mitch McConnell and Hawley and fellow, you know, well, you know the main players are.
Oh yeah.
See, these guys are proxies for the wealthy. They are proxies for the wealthy, and they are being paid to keep these working class white people in line. Just like Donald Trump, for example, he went up there and instigated that riot, most of these people, like I said, they were working class people. And he got on, and after his little insurrection scheme didn't work, he got on the Air Force One, paid for by American tax dollars, and flew down to Mar-a-Lago in his private club. And I guarantee you he had not invited not one of those people down there. He went down there and closed the gate. Now, I'm not giving those people, those insurrectionists, any excuse. I'm not giving them any excuse. What they did was wrong. They were grown people, and they need to be held responsible for their actions. But I think if they don't do something to Donald Trump, they don't need to do nothing to them people. Because Donald Trump was the leader of it. He incited it. He caused it. And here's another thing. I know it's crazy for me to even say that. Donald Trump would have been more, I'd have had more respect for Donald Trump if he had pardoned those people as opposed to those rich friends and cronies of his. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, sir. I know. I totally agree with you, man. We're going to have to leave it right there, brother. My time is up. Our time is up. We got another plane to catch. We're getting ready to ride with North Carolina Black Voters Matter bi-monthly partnership meeting right now, brother. Those guys don't stop. That's what it's going to take. We got to keep working. We can't sit down on our laurels. We can't rest on our laurels because we had a few victories this election season. Because they are working right now to destroy everything that President Biden is doing. Trust me, they're trying to figure out a way to stop it and destroy it. So we have to keep working, keep fighting. Like you say, keep doing the good fight. Ladies and gentlemen,
this is
the Real Radio Show. What you say, Joseph?
I was going to say we need to start getting ready right now for 2024.
Keep working. That's all I was saying. That's what I'm saying, brother. Like I said, I'm getting ready to get on the call. Like, what does it matter? They are staying working like the good old brothers and sisters with Black Voters Matter. Big props, man. They did some things. And, trust me, the devil is out here running around right now trying to figure out how to stop it. But we got to fight just as hard, brother. Ladies and gentlemen, listen to the Reddit Brothers for Real Radio Show. We'll be back next week. Probably be two times as many brothers on the line next week. But we really enjoyed talking to Joseph tonight. Everybody give Joseph a big hand. Look, man, we're going to be looking at that Super Bowl. We're going to be seeing what those Eagles are going to do, man. I know you're proud and you got a right to be.
Hey, Punchin.
Yes, sir.
I'm going to be cooking ribs and steak and chicken and fish on the grill that weekend. So come on up, brother.
All right, man. I'm packing up. I'm packing right now, brother.
All right, man.
All right, man. Love you, man. Have a good one.
You too, brother. All right.
Yes, sir. All right. Good night, everybody.